Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org. All right, everyone. Well, welcome back to Mormon Stories Podcast. We're now in hour two with author Brant Gardner. His book is entitled The Gift and Power, Translating the Book of Mormon. You can get this book at Greg Cofford Books. It's Greg Cofford, K-O-F-F-O-R-D.com. You can purchase the book there along with lots of other good books. And if you use the code MSTORIES, I believe is the code, you can get 20% off your purchases there. That code needs to be all in caps, MSTORIES, all in caps. And again, if you buy a book through us, you'll get a discount and a little bit will come to Mormon Stories. So in our first hour, we learned a little bit about Brant, and then we dove into Joseph Smith. We talked about the first vision. We talked about the folk magic and treasure digging stuff and his use of a seer stone or a stone to do some of that treasure seeking. And now we're going to dive into what really is the core of your book, Brant, and that's the translation of the Book of Mormon. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So I don't know. Let me just see if I can remember what I know about church history, which is little. But basically, there was no mention of the Book of Mormon in the first vision, right?
Correct.
Okay. So it what, 1820, what, 3, 4? When did Moroni first appear to Joseph?
You see, now you're going to get me.
Oh, I'm sorry. I shouldn't put you on the spot with the
year.
Yeah,
really? Come on.
Sorry.
Now that we have all these computer tools to remember things like dates, we don't have to have them on the
tip of
our tongue anymore.
Okay, so sometime within, what, 5 years after the first vision, Moroni appears, right?
Right.
Okay. And what does he say to Joseph, basically?
Well, the gist of it is that there is a record on golden plates, and that Joseph is to translate that and bring its message to the world. And then it takes him, 4 years of trying to be, at least in the terms of the story, to be worthy enough to be able to receive the plates. And then after he has the plates in his possession, there is some period of time where he has the plates and has not yet begun the translation. And the story of Martin Harris taking some of the characters to Charles Anthon comes during that period of time that seems to be before any real translation had begun.
Okay. So let's go ahead. I guess this is as good a time as any. Let's go ahead and back up and talk about the Book of Mormon and these gold plates for a second. Everyone's going to, unless you're just never learned anything about Mormonism, they're going to know that the Book of Mormon claims to begin around, 600 BC, where there's a family in Jerusalem. It's presumed that they're Jews or Israelites in some fashion. And, there's a prophet named Lehi who's told by God to leave Jerusalem and come to America, or to leave Jerusalem, and that he'll take his family to a new world to inhabit it and to perpetuate and multiply and replenish the earth, I guess you could say. And so, and I don't know exactly when we would think that plates started being engraved upon, or whether for the first several years of that history, the history is recorded in some other way, but what we do know from the Book of Mormon is that Lehi and his family leave Jerusalem, wander somewhere, through the Middle East for a while, eventually build a boat and sail over to the Americas. At least that's what we're taught. Now, any corrections you want to make to the story up to that point, Brant?
That's the basic story. Just the only thing we know about the engraving on the plates is that it was occurring by at least 30 years after they had been in the New World. Whether or not they would do anything earlier than that, we don't have direct evidence for it.
Okay. And so, and we know, well, the story is that the plates were engraved on little sheets of gold and, or leaves of gold, and that the language that they were written in is Reformed Egyptian. Is that right?
That it was called Reformed Egyptian by the time the compiler of the plates, Mormon, is writing. It wasn't called Reformed Egyptian when the Nephi, who was the first one who was writing on it, was writing. At that point in time, the only thing it says indicates somehow that it was Egyptian. And then by the time Mormon is writing, something has changed so that they say, oh, well, it's Reformed Egyptian. It's something different.
So why Egyptian? Like, first of all, how likely is it that a family of Israelites would know Egyptian?
You know, that's kind of an interesting question, and Hugh Nibley had answered that by saying that this was a, you know, when the 600 BC was a time of tremendous Egyptian influence in Jerusalem, and positing that Lehi would have been some sort of a trader that would have therefore known something about Egyptian. I recently did some more work looking at the figure of Nephi, and based on a book I was reading talking about what scribes were like in that area of the world, it struck me that Nephi had to have been trained as a scribe. And in that kind of a training, one of the languages that the scribes would have learned, even in Jerusalem, was Egyptian. So if you look at that background and the evidence that there might be for Nephi having had scribal training, then it makes perfect sense that he would have known and perhaps written something in Egyptian due to that training.
So do we have documents from 600 BC written in or around Jerusalem that are written in Egyptian? Like,
you certainly have documents that are written in Egyptian, and some of the more interesting ones are those that are written with Egyptian script but Hebrew words.
Really?
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why the people at the Maxwell Institute will say that it is highly likely that what's happening is you have Nephi, who is writing in his language, which would be Hebrew, but in a vocabulary, or not a vocabulary, but in a written style that borrowed the characters from Egyptian. And we certainly should not think of what we see from, like, you know, temple Egyptian hieroglyphics, more the probably the Demotic, the Meroitic, one of those, you know, more freehand, quicker types of scripts than the ones that we see that have all of those wonderful pictures on them whenever we see things in Egyptian temples.
So again, why not Hebrew?
There isn't any really good evidence for that, except that for some reason it appears that the brass plates that they took with them that were so important that they went back to get them, those appear to have been in, and again, the text says Egyptian, and whether it means Egyptian language and Egyptian characters or Egyptian characters and Hebrew language, we really don't know. I strongly suspect that it was the brass plates' influence that dictated Nephi's choice of what he would do, because he was imitating those scriptures that they had. Now, why were the brass plates there? It's because they were a remnant of the house of Joseph, and Joseph, of course, has traditional history going back into Egypt.
Okay, so the brass plates were in some form of Egyptian, and
right.
So it makes sense that they would just keep with that same language.
That would be his model, and although it doesn't say so in the Book of Mormon, it makes sense that because the brass plates had this golden sheen and they were on plates, that's what inspires Nephi to find the ability to create some sort of metal plates that again have that sheen to them and to record his history. And again, although it's pure speculation, I would guess that since Nephi had to make them himself, that he used the brass plate's size you know, as his model. And that's why the plates ended up in the size they were, because they were, again, intentional imitations of those brass plates.
Okay. And has there ever been Egyptian writings found in Mesoamerica that would indicate from an external source that Egyptian was known commonly in ancient America?
None that I'm aware of. But of course, you also have to understand that there is a sort of limited understanding of what the multiple writing systems might have been. There are some hints of a large number of them, but so few representative characters that we know there were a lot of writing systems around, and we just don't have enough of them that we know what they were. And most of the writing systems we have are coming from post-Christian era, so somewhere after the time of Christ. And one of the reasons for that is that by that time, that's when the Maya started carving all of their writings in stone, and we still have those. It wasn't until, probably 3 or 4 years ago that they uncovered a temple in San Bartolo where they found this marvelous paintings inside the temple. And they had hieroglyphic texts in a form that was much earlier than the later glyphic texts, enough that they cannot yet read all of it. They can see that, you know, it's similar. They know that this was, you know, that these were Maya writing, but they can't read it because it was some earlier form of the script and not one that anybody had seen before or could even have anticipated because it was painted. Right. So apparently they were writing for a long time. We just lost it, unfortunately.
Okay, so you're saying on the one hand, no, they've never found Egyptian in Mesoamerica, but at the same time, there's probably lots of languages that we don't have that would have been destroyed or deteriorated,
yeah,
or that we haven't yet discovered.
Yeah, or that we have, you know, two or three characters of them, and, you know, we can guess that there was a writing system there, but we cannot discern what it was like.
If I were to pick your random PhD Egyptologist and ask them if they're aware of anything called Reformed Egyptian, what would they say, do you think?
Oh, they'd laugh. There isn't anything like Reformed Egyptian, and in their world, that would be absolutely true. The only place that a Reformed Egyptian exists is in the Book of Mormon, and then only as an indication that whatever it is that they were writing was no longer what was considered Egyptian. So exactly what it might have been like, no one knows. The only thing you can guarantee is that it couldn't have been anything like anything that you would have in the old world, because you've got a separation of, over 1,000 years between them. And there's no way that you'd have parallel development in the way scripts are created and changed.
What would a skeptic say? Like, did Joseph ever produce characters from the Book of Mormon?
The only copies that, you know, the only indication that we have is what has become known as the Anthon transcript, which is somewhat in debate because when Charles Anthon described the paper that Martin Harris gave him, that description doesn't fit the piece of paper that we have now that we call the Anthon transcript. So there is a piece of paper that has some characters on it, and it has the label characters excuse me, at the top, and that's all we have. There isn't, for those who have looked at it, it has no relationship that anybody currently knows to any known script.
We know that Joseph did take these characters to someone to be validated, right?
Right.
And we do have a piece of paper that is allegedly reported to be a remnant from that, right?
Either from that or certainly some characters that were from the plates. So we do have a few lines that appear to represent characters that were on the plates.
And it's reasonable to think that those were the characters that Joseph showed to Anthon, right?
Possible. The only reason for saying it might not have been is that Anton gave a description that doesn't match that piece of paper.
Okay, but you've said yourself that memory can be faulty and...
Oh, exactly.
Okay, so very well could be, right?
Yes.
Okay, and so if that... And we don't have any reason to believe that it's not from sources other than Anton, right? I mean, where did that remnant come from? Do we know?
That's how I'm trying to remember.
Wasn't it ever reproduced one of the church newspapers or publications?
It was reproduced in broadsides and handed out. So it was certainly recognized as a representative of what the characters would have been.
Okay, so I mean, chances are the church published this because it was what Joseph showed Anton.
Right.
Okay, and so if an Egyptologist looked at that today, would he go, oh yeah, that's totally Egyptian, or what would he say?
He would look at it and say, no, that's not Egyptian.
Would it resemble anything?
I haven't seen any script that it resembles. Basically, what happens is when you look at a script that you don't know, you compare it to everything that you do know, and it always resembles something and then doesn't resemble anything. Mm-hmm. So I have seen people who have said they have some training in some of these Egyptian scripts, and they say, yeah, it looks similar to that. Some people say it looks similar to shorthand, and when you really get into looking at any of those, it isn't any of them. Basically, it is a unique script that we have no copy of anywhere else. And of course, from the standpoint of Egyptian, that's hardly surprising because we've got well over 1,000 years of separation between whatever script it was that they started with and the one that later was somehow changed, and sufficiently changed that Mormon would say, hey, this is Reformed Egyptian. It's not Egyptian anymore.
Okay. Let me flip the tables just for a second and ask you to play the role of a critic. If Joseph was making up the Book of Mormon and trying to convince people that this was credible, or trying to even create a plausible story, would he have had an incentive to claim that it was Reformed Egyptian he was translating from? In other words, some language that no one would possibly know.
Well, at the time he produced the Book of Mormon, nobody knew Egyptian. They had seen various characters, and certainly Egyptian was popular, but nobody could read it at the time. So this is before Champollion came along and used the Rosetta Stone to be able to translate it. So at this point in time, if I were trying to come up with a reason why Joseph would choose that out of thin air, it would be because the idea of exotic things being Egyptian, was certainly in the air at the time. And if you were going to come up with something that nobody could read, Egyptian was as good as anything else because everybody knew you couldn't read it.
Okay. And Reformed Egyptian would be one step further beyond the unreadable, right?
Exactly.
Okay. So he would want to say it was some text that he would have a good chance of, well, he would want to produce characters that would have a very low probability of ever being declared a fraud. And so he would do that by saying that they're in some language that theoretically, 600 BC Israelis would have access to, but in a derivation that no one would ever be able to then determine as fraudulent later. Is that right?
that puts a really heavy weight on Joseph's understanding, but yeah, you could make that case.
Okay.
I don't think you could hold that case, but you can certainly make it.
What would keep that case from holding?
That's a pretty sophisticated understanding of both the nature of what you're trying to produce fraudulently and kind of a pretty sophisticated way of putting it together. There's no indication that Joseph had training or sufficient imagination to be able to come up with anything that was quite that slick.
Right.
I mean, Orson Scott Card might be able to come up with some story like that, but I'm not even sure I've seen anything in his imagination that has been quite like that one.
But wasn't Joseph brilliant? I mean, a lot of the time it seems like a classic, and I'm just going to say apologetic technique, but on the one hand, we want to sing praise to the man. On the other hand, we want to say he was an uneducated yokel, you know? And the truth is, even the most hardened skeptics of Joseph will claim that he was brilliant.
It depends on what the popular view is. Certainly at the time, he was not considered brilliant. He was a spindle-shanked ignoramus. Most people were pretty certain that the Book of Mormon couldn't be true because Joseph was, an idiot, and the best evidence of it was this, terrible Book of Mormon. And then the more people have had to deal with Joseph Smith and what his life was like and what he was able to accomplish have had to say, okay, well, the evidence of his life suggests something else. So you've got this wild variation between, the village idiot and, maybe the idiot savant. But certainly when you look at what Joseph Smith accomplished, it is unusual for anyone, and then the question is, okay, how do we explain the fact that that was unusual? Do we explain it because he had this innate brilliance for invention, or because there was some inspiration involved, or is, there's some combination, and I'm probably leaning to the combination. I think he was a very intelligent person who wasn't given credit for it. But I still don't see him having the sophistication to be able to come up with, at that point in his life, something that was, that sophisticated. And particularly when you start looking at the Book of Mormon itself and what he produced, it would require, an incredible genius to have been able to come up with that.
Right. Well, I'm going to come to that in just one second, but I'm just going to go back. If he had manufactured the characters of supposedly reformed Egyptian, what was he taking those to Anthon for? If he had made those up and knew that no one would be able to validate them because he didn't want anyone to be able to uncover his fraud, why would he be taking those characters to a professor?
Yeah, another part of the theoretical genius, if Joseph is going to be putting it together, and I think your question is an astute one. If it were a fraud, trying to have someone vindicate the fraud would be really kind of crazy. The actual story, based on what we see of it, is that the function of that was to convince Martin Harris. Joseph at the time may not have understood how to translate the Book of Mormon, may not have known what the method was going to be. There seems to be some indication that he was floundering trying to figure out how the Book of Mormon would be translated, and took some of those characters off, or had Martin Harris go do it, just to be able to see if there was someone that would be able to translate them. And of course, the end of that story is Joseph Smith begins translating and Martin Harris becomes a believer. Exactly how all those events work out is again part of history. But
so it was Harris that took the remnant,
right? Martin Harris is the one who took the script and was the one who is it Williams that he went to first? There were two people he visited, and Anthon was the second.
And somehow, either Harris was part of the scheme, which would make you wonder why he took the remnants there, or he was duped, but somehow left that interview believing in the fraud, right?
Yeah, and that's again one of those really interesting things, because Martin Harris is a skeptic. Everything that we see about Martin is that he does not believe easily. He certainly comes to believe. But he tells Joseph, I have to see, I have to understand. I can't just believe you at your word. You need to show me something. So there were several times when there was something that occurred because Martin Harris was a skeptic and needed to have some sort of confirmation. And this, whatever else happened with Charles Anthon, The result of it was that Martin Harris became convinced that Joseph Smith not only had the plates, but was to translate them.
Okay. Okay. All right. So, there's part of me trying to debate whether to tackle this now or later, but I'm going to go ahead and tackle it now. When you read Grant Palmer's book, An Insider's View of Mormon Origins, he basically has a theory which many find to be pretty plausible about how Joseph came up with the book. And I'll recite what I remember about it.
Okay.
He basically would say that, let's just say, a fifth or a sixth of the book comes from Joseph Smith's own narrative. You know, he had older brothers. He had a father who was a visionary. There's evidence that Lehi's dream is very similar to a dream that Joseph Smith Sr. had. Maybe Joseph saw himself in the Nephi figure who was more righteous than his older brothers, and, you know, whatever else, you know, let's just say a sixth is Joseph's own narrative. Another sixth is just direct copying from the King James Version of the Bible that Joseph had, which, as I understand, there were errors. We know what version of the King James Bible Joseph Smith had. That version had errors in it, and those errors make it into the Book of Mormon in the places where the Book of Mormon is supposedly recounting what's in the Bible. So that then accounts for a fifth or a sixth of the Book of Mormon is directly copied out of Joseph Smith's own Bible. Then you have a fifth or a sixth that come from sermons that would have been given with some level of frequency at the burned over district. These evangelical Presbyterian or Methodist or whatever ministers that would come through would give these big old long sermons on basic traditional, you know, Christian thought, King Benjamin sermons and whoever else gave sermons in the Book of Mormon, you could say very much resemble those speeches given on the frontier. And I think Grant Palmer tries to demonstrate those similarities. Then you have all these wars that were happening and the writings about the wars that I guess Grant Palmer would link to whatever warfare was happening in the early 1800s. I'm not familiar enough, or I don't remember exactly what he was tying that to. And then you've got just this whole Masonic sort of stuff going on in New York where some people got murdered and they blamed it on the Masonic Lodge, and the Masonic Lodge was this sort of secret combination. And so you'd see a lot of this talk about secret combinations, et cetera, maybe coming from all that talk about the Masons and secret combinations in New York. I don't know. You can tell me if I'm missing some other sources that Grant Palmer would allege. But in Grant Palmer's and then you've got The View of the Hebrews, which is, you know, a book that Oliver Cowdery would have had access to that was written apparently by Oliver Cowdery's preacher or minister, which basically is this narrative that Native Americans have a Hebrew origin. And as I understand it, in The View of the Hebrews, there's this family that comes over in a boat, comes to America, and settles here, and there's a good group and a bad group, and eventually the bad group kills off the good group. I could have it all wrong, but that's my understanding of a basic narrative in The View of the Hebrews that again, you know, people in the 1820s and early 1830s would have had access to, would have been thinking about. And if you just sort of take Joseph, or maybe he collaborated with Oliver Cowdery and Sidney Rigdon or others, if you just sort of assume that they had these sources for inspiration, the Book of Mormon becomes not this miraculous, amazing text, but instead it becomes this hodgepodge of synthesis that you can trace to some very specific, some extant sources that are reasonable to then lead to the manufacturing of the book or the creation of the book. Like, you know, on the one hand, you've got to believe that God exists and that he works with angels and that they're, you know, having these golden plates manufactured and hidden and produced to Joseph, you know, that's a pretty, that's a pretty big stretch on reason right there. Then well, you've got this, then you've got this other version, which you might say is a stretch, but maybe this other version is a bit less of a stretch than the idea that Occam's razor might invoke, which is that it was all manufactured.
What we need to do, though, is kind of look at some of the specifics, and I do have to correct kind of...
Please, because I'm wrong.
The view of the view of the Hebrews piece. We'll get to that one in a second. But you know, if you begin with the dichotomy of saying, well, on the one hand, you have to believe in God, and the other, you don't need to have God invoked. I agree that you're not going to get anywhere with the Book of Mormon if you say there is no God and therefore there are no angels. That sort of predisposes you to say that you've got to find some explanation for the Book of Mormon that doesn't involve God or angels. And so you'll find something. The question is, does this one, using your synopsis of Grant Palmer, does that actually explain anything? So let's start kind of backwards. View of the Hebrews. The synopsis you gave was actually of Solomon Spaulding's manuscript found. And the synopsis that you gave really wasn't even of that book. It was of what people said about that book when they were reminded of what the Book of Mormon was. And they said, oh, yeah, I seem to remember that that's what this manuscript found was.
So the view of the Hebrews, is there anything in the narrative of the view of the Hebrews that I'm not saying is Nephi in the view of the Hebrews? Is there anything in the view of the Hebrews that mirrors what's in the Book of Mormon?
What would be in the view of the Hebrews would be the use of Isaiah to support an Israelite presence in the New World, and using that to explain, you know, Native Americans, and I think probably a more civilized and less civilized version. Those kinds of things
people.
Of the Native Americans.
Would there be a light and a dark skinned people in the view of the Hebrews?
Nope. Of course, I don't think there is one in the Book of Mormon either. So,
okay, we can talk about that later.
Yeah.
Okay, but definitely a Hebrew origin for Native Americans, or at least some Native Americans,
right? And what it really
and came,
was
and
at
a
the
family
time,
that comes over on a boat, right?
No, that wasn't there. That's not in view of the Hebrews. That is only in the unsupported recollections about Solomon Spaulding's manuscript that after his manuscript was found and you could read it, wasn't there. Another one of those sort of faulty memory kinds of things that was primed by someone saying, don't you remember it being similar to this? And they're going, oh, yeah, I think so. It was one of those where the evidence was really appeared damaging to the Book of Mormon until they actually found the manuscript and read it. And they said, oh, wait a minute, those people, you know, we're not remembering it correctly.
Yeah, I mean, even Von Brody doesn't give much credence to the Spaulding theory, right?
No. And you can, BYU published the book. And certainly, if they were going to publish it, they didn't think that it had anything damaging in it to the Book of Mormon.
Okay, so we don't know. Okay, wait. I'm sorry. I Googled View of the Hebrews in Wikipedia.
Uh-huh.
It says the peopling of the New World from the Old via a long journey northward, which encountered seas of many waters.
Yep.
Now that so, there is water, but you're saying what? It's not necessarily a naval migration or what?
Oh, I'm sure it was, but there aren't that many similarities. What you have to look at in any of these things is this whole concept of what do you do with parallels? And one of the problems with using parallels as a methodology is you can probably draw parallels with just about anything. And depending on who it is that you're trying to influence, you can construct a parallel that says, wow, doesn't this look similar? And the way you do it is by always pulling out the things that look similar and never pulling out the things that say, well, wait a minute, this is completely different.
But isn't that what apologists do?
Certainly have been a lot who did. I mean,
isn't that what chiasmus is? I mean, you find these patterns in the Book of Mormon and you say, oh, well, that really seems ancient, you know.
Oh, no. I mean, Kaya's, there have been people who've done statistical analysis to try to find out intentionality of a chiasm. You know, the literary form of chiasm is absolutely authentic. It was surprising to find it in the Book of Mormon. What happened at one point in time is too many people thought that it actually proved something. And the only thing it proved is you can find that literary form in the Book of Mormon. But it's absolutely true that you can find it there and that you can perform statistical analysis that will indicate that it's intentional. I think that it's gone over the top. I think that there are times when people find certain chiasms that are more in the eye of the beholder than in the text.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that, you know, that they're not there.
And this technique of finding parallels, I mean, that's what critics would use to tear down the Book of Mormon, and that's really the technique that Farms or the Maxwell Institute would use to build it up, to say, you know, oh, this with bees, or oh, that with certain names, and you would find parallels and then say that gives evidence, right? And
yeah,
what you're saying is either attempts to either tear down or build up based on drawing these parallels really says more about the person doing it than reality?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I remember going through a particular passage in Sahagun, who's one of the really important Spanish fathers writing about Aztec culture. And he says, you know, here is how all of these gods are like the Greek gods. Well, of course, Aztec gods aren't like the Greek gods at all, but he certainly makes it sound like they are. Burr Cody Brundage did the same kind of thing. He says, you know, here's why Sahagun might have thought that Quetzalcoatl would look like Heracles. And he goes through this list. And if you know something about the mythology, you know that he's only putting together the list that says this is why it might seem similar. But there isn't any real similarity at all, and many of the things that appear similar superficially aren't similar at all. And so that's part of the problem of, you know, any of these kinds of discussions that say, you know, this is parallel to that and therefore it proves something. It's not a good methodology, whether you use it for the Book of Mormon or against the Book of Mormon.
Okay. Okay. That, I think that makes sense. I agree. I think I agree mostly, especially with apologetic attempts to prove the Book of Mormon's true. But let me just go back to the view of the Hebrews really quickly and just read what Wikipedia says. So it's got extensive quotations from Isaiah, right?
Yep.
Israelite origins of the American Indian. It talks about the gathering of Israel and the restoration of the 10 tribes. It's got the peopling of the new world from the old via a journey and many waters.
Yep.
It's got a religious motive for the migration. It's got a division of those migrants into a civilized and an uncivilized group. And eventually it says the destruction of the civilized by the uncivilized. It talks about the burial of a lost book with yellow leaves. It talks about extensive military fortifications with watchtowers. It talks about a change from monarchy to republican forms of government. And it talks about the preaching of the gospel in ancient America. Now, that's all according to Wikipedia, which, you know, may or may not be true. But, I mean, now, can you be fair to say that would sound like it could at least inform the narrative of the Book of Mormon?
Well,
at least the arc, kind of the narc, narrative arc, a little bit?
Yes and no. And again, you're looking at something where, you know, hearing that, I can almost guarantee that whoever wrote that tried very hard to make it sound like the
right.
That Hebrews sounded like the Book of Mormon, because it doesn't sound that much like the Book of Mormon.
You've probably read it. I've never read it.
Oh, yeah.
You've read it?
Of course. Yeah.
Okay.
I wouldn't be able to say much about the Book of Mormon if I hadn't read it.
Okay.
You know, here's a couple of things that, you know, that are important. One of them is it talks about, you know, the old world Hebrews coming to the new world. In view of the Hebrews, this is an explanation for the lost 10 tribes. And there was a number of books. You know, there was a whole idea at this particular point in time that if you're trying to explain where the Native Americans came from, because in the biblical world you could only be a descendant of Noah, you didn't have a place for them. So people found a good place in the Lost Ten Tribes. So Native Americans became, you know, the remnant of the Lost Ten Tribes. And so everybody is pretty certain that that's parallel to the Book of Mormon, except the Book of Mormon starts 100 years after the loss of the Ten Tribes, happens with a completely different war, a completely different people, has nothing to do with the Ten Tribes except that Lehi is a descendant of one of them. But there's, you know, the Book of Mormon has nothing to do with the loss of the Ten Tribes. So, yeah, there's a parallel in that. Something has been lost, but it isn't a direct parallel. And the next one is the same kind of thing. You know, both of them quote Isaiah a lot. Absolutely true. All of the proof texts that Ethan Smith did in view of the Hebrews, the proof texts he used from Isaiah to prove this is what's happening, don't show up in the Book of Mormon. So, yeah, they both cite Isaiah, but they don't cite the same thing. You can't look at it and say, aha, this idea came from here.
Mm. You so know, it quotes different parts of Isaiah.
Yeah, it's completely different things and for different reasons.
Okay.
And if you go through all of it, it's that kind of thing. The fact that, I mean, if you read View of the Hebrews without being primed to think that it has any relationship to the Book of Mormon, I would defy anybody to come up with one.
Yeah, I tried to read it once, and I couldn't read it.
No, it's yeah. Well, and that's the other thing is it's, you know, early 1800s literature, and that's really pretty boring stuff.
Yeah, it was pretty thick for me at the time. Maybe I just wasn't motivated enough. I should say that Wikipedia says Mormon apologists argue that the parallels between the works are weak, overemphasized, or non-existent.
Yep, and that sentence itself verifies what I told you before, where it sounded like somebody was pulling those things out to make it sound parallel. It's exactly the thing that they're complaining about in the Mormon apologists. Yeah, it's the fallacy of parallels. It's you construct it by making it sound better than it is.
But that it sounds like you're making an argument against Fair and Farms, or at least their or the Maximalists to kind of their primary mode of operation. And I want to be honest. I'm not trying to get you to denounce them. I'm not trying to get you in trouble.
I know pretty much all of the people that are writing for them. So, yeah, you wouldn't get me to denounce them. Many of them are friends of mine. So,
but are you saying that what they're doing is maybe not useful or counterproductive or problematic or helpful? You know, what would you say about the fact that they're relying on this parallelism that you say is not necessarily to be trusted?
Well, I'd say two things. One of them is the Maxwell Institute is, you know, not a single entity. That's a lot of different people. Mm-hmm. So you really can't answer that question without saying, how about this particular article? What's it doing?
Okay.
But secondly, I think in many cases, I don't see what the majority of them are doing as being that kind of parallelism. Some of it is, and when it is, I'm not overly fond of it, and I'll say so. But there are a lot of the things that they're doing that are, you know, are not really relying on that kind of parallels.
Okay. All right. Well, I honestly am not trying to get you in trouble there, but that's a fair question, right? I mean,
oh, of course. And one of the questions that anybody would have to ask of anything I've written is how do I avoid the fallacy of parallels? Right. And the problem there is you cannot write anything in history without trying to make some sort of a connection. If you're going to do a biblical history, you have to draw some sort of parallel somewhere. And the question is, you know, are you drawing a parallel that is completely superficial or one that has some validity? And when William Deaver was looking at that same problem, what he said was, you know, let's use a different word. Rather than parallel, let's talk about a convergence. And in his vocabulary, a convergence was when two or three different things start pulling together at the same time period and in the same place. What I would say for the Book of Mormon, what you have to do is start making sure that if you're looking at parallels, it's not so much that it's parallel lines as it is intersecting lines at a point mm-hmm. where you've got multiple things that are all pointing to the same place, same time. Where parallels get really bad is when you say, you know, let me take the fact that they use Isaiah in view of the Hebrews and the Book of Mormon uses Isaiah, and therefore it's parallel, and therefore it's borrowed. That one doesn't hold up because they're not the same. You know, when you actually examine it, the connection doesn't work. There are other places where you start looking at them and you say, well, wait a minute, you know, something else is happening here. And you know, they're converging in time and place and culture and in non-random ways. And those are much more important than, you know, there's a chiasm in Greek and there's a chiasm of the Book of Mormon. That certainly doesn't tell us that the Book of Mormon was written in Greek.
Right. Okay, so let's go back to the overall Grant Palmer thesis. We talked about view of the Hebrews and why we need to be careful between we make too much of that connection. Although it is fair to say that that this idea of Native Americans having a Hebrew origin it would have been a milieu that Joseph was swimming in, right? It would have been a popular notion, or at least a notion that some would have been considering, right?
Oh, yeah. It was certainly well understood at the time. The difference, of course, being that they would have expected it to have something to do with the 10 tribes. And okay. The fact that the Book of Mormon expressly has nothing to do with the 10 tribes is a little strange for somebody who's trying to, if you will, pander to that milieu. But
okay. What about just the other, so just address real quickly the other elements of the Palmer thesis. Maybe not in particular, just overall, or whatever you want to say about it.
Again, it's one where if you look very carefully at what the correlations are, you'll find that they're at a very, very high level, and that they are written in such a way to make them look more parallel than they are. For example, you were talking about the Masonic
right. stories or rumbling.
Yeah, they okay, come on. Why am I forgetting the specific conspiracy word there?
Secret combination.
Secret combinations. You would think I would know that. You know, that whole idea of the Masons as a secret combination would probably work until you go through the Book of Mormon and you can't find it. There is very, very little that you would say is Masonic about what's happening to secret combinations in the Book of Mormon. Their function in the text is completely different. Where they show up is completely different. It again is one of those correlations that looks better from 30,000 feet than it does when you make the direct comparisons.
And you'd say that about the evangelical sermons, you'd say that about, you know.
Well, actually, with the evangelical sermons, the two things that, you know, again, go back to the book, The Gift and the Power, which we kind of haven't talked about as much as we might have, but.
Oh, we will. We will. I promise.
Yeah. But the two things that go back to that are what do we do with all of the texts that show up that are in the Bible that appear to be copied out of the Bible, and these sermons. And one of the things that happens with the sermons is that you get a lot of the same language coming out. So to sing the song of redeeming love, which is put in the mouth of Alma in the Book of Mormon, is something that is part of the rhetoric of those sermons. That all gets to the question of translation. And again, if you begin by positing that the translation has to be word for word perfectly accurate, okay, then you don't have any way of explaining those things. And that's why one of the reasons that, you know, sort of the second third of the book goes through the nature of translation isn't just what kinds of translations might it be, which, you know, the possibilities run the gamut from an absolutely perfect to a completely conceptual, you know, tangentially related, but, you know, not the same words kind of translation like the Good News Bible. So, you know, with that range of possibilities, then you have to start looking at the evidence. You know, what does the evidence say about the kind of translation that we have. And one of the things that I think it clearly shows in the evidence is that Joseph's vocabulary strongly influenced the vocabulary that you have in the Book of Mormon. And sometimes we have places where we know that the vocabulary in the Book of Mormon is a direct reflection of not only the Bible that he had, but in some cases, even when we know that the source that would have been quoted would have been on the brass plates and would have been part of the Old Testament, the particular translation of that is the version out of the New Testament that's translating, you know, that's quoting that rather than the version that you find in the Old Testament. So I think that tells us something about the nature of translation, but it doesn't tell us whether it was a translation. It just says, here's some of the evidence you have to take into account when you look at what kind of translation
okay.
it was.
So we'll get into it. We'll put a pin in this, but if I could just restate what I think I heard you say, it's that, you know, let's say that Joseph had a sermon of, you know, of King Benjamin to translate. You need to first agree upon what it means to translate. And if he's trying to convey some sentiments that he's translating, he very well might, according to a certain version of what it means to translate, invoke the vocabulary and maybe even the phraseology of sermons that he might have heard on the frontier and incorporate them as the way to express what he's translating.
Exactly.
Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. And I'll give you a sort of a very personal example of that kind of thing. I was taking a class in Greek at Brigham Young University, and the teacher happened to give us a passage out of Matthew to translate. And when we started, we didn't really know what it was, but, you know, working our way into the passage, the entire class recognized that verse. And almost to a person, translated exactly the way we have memorized that in the King James Version. And, of course, that was what the teacher had expected us to do, and then went on to say, you know, here's why the actual vocabulary is slightly different. But as soon as we recognized what it was, yeah, every one of us translated it exactly the way we had always translated before. So that's, you know, that's such a natural process that I certainly see that as one of the explanations for how some of these vocabulary items end up in the Book of Mormon.
Okay. All right. So you've been very patient. I couldn't help but address some of these things before we dig into the book, just because I think you're a unique individual who can speak to these in, let's just say, as credible as a way as I've ever heard. And so I didn't want to let you go without addressing them. So I'm going to throw you this last question just at a high level. And it's really a chance for you to just bear your testimony about the Book of Mormon. But I'm going to just, I'll just summarize it in this way. And then I promise we'll go right to your book. Well, we've been talking about your book, but we'll go specifically to the translation part of your book. So somebody might say, look, I've had people say this. The Book of Mormon is not that amazing. I mean, in the church, we've got this culture of saying how amazing the book is. But in reality, if you take these five or six sources that Grant Palmer posits, if you take the fact that maybe it wasn't just Joseph that wrote it, but instead Joseph collaborated with Sidney Rigdon or Oliver Cowdery or others over a period of years instead of unnecessarily constraining it to a matter of weeks or months. You know, J.R.R. Tolkien came up with much better. You know, lots of people could come up with, through fiction, something that would equal to or even surpass the marvel of the Book of Mormon. It's just not that amazing. And these sources, using Occam's razor, provide a much more credible explanation for how the book was manufactured than something supernatural. How would you just summarize your feelings as a response to that argument?
I think the argument has validity if and only if you put as your beginning point that there cannot be anything supernatural. So once you've said that the supernatural isn't possible, anything that allows you to come up with an explanation that isn't supernatural becomes plausible, all based on the fact that you can't accept anything else. Now, if you say I believe that there is a God and that some of these things are possible. Now the question is, you know, what kind of text is the Book of Mormon? And from my experience, the more I have really delved into the Book of Mormon and looked at it very, very closely, it does not, you know, the picture that's painted of these external sources and these proposed parallels that are supposed to explain the text don't reflect the text at all. It isn't the same book that I see. There are two kinds of things that will kind of tell you that the Book of Mormon is probably more marvelous than we actually understand it. And one of them is the nature of its construction. It's not only pretty complex, but there's some really unusual and interesting things going on in it. But the second and most important is the kinds of things that are going on and the kinds of things that it's interested in have direct connections not only to historical places and time, but to the events and the concerns and the reasons why human beings would do the things that they did that are absolutely relevant to the particular place and time. And they change through time. So, you know, the things that Nephi is worried about and the reason he writes his record have a lot to do with traditions from the old world. By the time you get to King Benjamin, who is giving his discourse, there isn't a connection to the old world anymore, and references that he gives become explicable only in the context of this new world that he's in. One of the examples, just to give you one, he spends time at the beginning of his sermon talking about what kind of king he is not. That is a really strange way to begin a sermon unless you are contrasting yourself to other kings that they would know about. And when you look at the kinds of things where he says, I'm not that kind of guy, those are the qualifications that you begin to see in the Mesoamerican kings that would have been around him. So when you put it into an historical context, it becomes richer in ways that Joseph Smith didn't even have access to, let alone come up with some of these 30,000-foot parallels.
Got it. So you strike me as a bright guy. You've spent a lot of time with the Book of Mormon, and for you, the Book of Mormon is every bit as sophisticated and as intricate and as marvelous as many believers would testify.
And probably more so, because I suspect that most of the people who read it with modern eyes, and you know what they are seeing as complex or interesting, are probably completely different kinds of things than what I'm seeing in the text.
I see. Okay. Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. 'Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive, to the sand joy. Your hearts will swell, courage take. journey